Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, will the proposed Syrian ceasefire plan take hold?
There really is a great deal of skepticism.
A look at how to defeat ISIS and preserve the unity of Iraq. An Obama administration move to close the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. And who didn't show up for the Grammy Music Awards? It's right here on The Voice of America. Syria says it accepts a ceasefire plan proposed by the United States and Russia that would begin Saturday. A government statement said the military will continue its operations against Islamic State and Al-Qaeda-linked groups. The plan does not apply to those militants, and any other groups have until Friday to confirm their participation. The main Syrian opposition High Negotiations Committee said late Monday it agrees to the ceasefire as long as its demands for the lifting of sieges, delivery of humanitarian aid, and an end of bombings of civilians are met. Reporter Jamie Detmer was recently on the Turkish-Syria border, and he joins us on the line today from Rome. Welcome, Jamie.
Thanks for having me on, Susan.
Well, what was the feeling where you were about a ceasefire?
Well, it's been pretty consistent amongst the rebel commanders anyway, and really within the Syrian opposition, the political opposition, of a great deal of skepticism about this. For them, one of the key problems with the cessation proposal is this non-inclusion of Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate, and possibly other groups. I mean, it's meant to be those groups defined by the UN as terrorists. But as we've seen, really, with the Damascus administration and with the Kremlin and Moscow, they're pretty wide about how they define terrorists. It's, you know, quite frequently anyone who's opposed to President Bashar al-Assad. One of the drawbacks for them is this: that they believe that the regime with Russian backing is wanting to swing the offensive now that it has completed a lot of its operations in northern Aleppo to a neighboring province, Idlib, where Jabhat al-Nusra and some other groups are really focused and have a stronghold there. And the theory is that they want to then close the border crossing that comes into Idlib from Turkey, which would mean then all supply routes from Turkey would basically have been cut by the regime in this blistering event of the last 2 weeks. And so they see this non-inclusion of Jabhat al-Nusra as a pretext, really, for carrying on with an offensive, but having the stamp of approval of Western nations, because Jabhat al-Nusra has been written out of this cessation of hostilities.
A previous proposed ceasefire did not work out. Do you think this time it may come into effect, may be followed?
Well, I mean, to be perfectly frank, amongst commanders, amongst Syrian political opposition I speak to privately, amongst European diplomats, amongst refugees themselves, there really is a great deal of skepticism whether this cessation will come off. There are quite a lot of other problems with it. You mentioned some of the demands of the Syrian political opposition. You left one out, and that is that there's meant to be the releasing of political detainees by the Assad regime, and that seems unlikely that they will do it. I think that there are lots of wiggle room on all sides to cause problems with this cessation. There's another one as well. One of the reasons they're using the term cessation of hostilities legally rather than ceasefire is this whole question: if you have a ceasefire, there's a legal framework, there's enforcement and monitoring. And as the UN admitted a month ago, they don't have the ability to really monitor abuses of the cessation.
Is anybody making any suggestions other than this ceasefire or cessation of hostilities?
The general idea of a political solution, but, you know, a political deal, as far as Assad's opponents are concerned, is that he must go. It's a bottom line for them, that he can play no part in a political transition, for example. And then, of course, the position of Damascus and Moscow is that Assad shouldn't necessarily have to go. I mean, certainly in Damascus, the Assad regime thinks that he should be staying. There has been some suggestion that maybe Moscow down the road will be prepared to back the idea of Assad going, as long as he's replaced with someone who's acceptable to Moscow.
Thank you for joining us today on the program.
Thanks very much for having me on.
There is a new development in the Syria truce agreement to tell you about, and it comes from social media. Michael Lippin is here with details. Michael, what are you hearing?
Thanks, Susan. Well, I'm hearing that the Russian Defense Ministry has used its Twitter and Facebook accounts a short time ago to announce that it's taken a step toward implementing that deal with the United States. It says Russia has created what it calls a coordination center for reconciliation of the warring sides in the Syrian conflict. All the warring sides, except for the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, as you and Jamie Detmer were just discussing. Now, the Russian government says the Reconciliation Center has been set up at the Khmeimim Air Base near the Syrian port of Latakia. Moscow says the center will facilitate negotiations between the Syrian government, its longtime ally, and Syrian opposition groups, while also organizing humanitarian aid deliveries in Syria. You can find the Russian Defense Ministry on Facebook by searching for the Ministry of Defense of the Russian Federation, and it's on Twitter at MOD_Russia.
Well, what has the U.S. side been saying about the Syria truce?
Well, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has been speaking about Syria today while testifying at a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing, and his comments are just now starting to get picked up on Twitter. One Twitter user monitoring Kerry's remarks is the Jerusalem Post's Washington bureau chief Michael Wilner, whose handle is at M.A. Wilner. He tweeted a short time ago, asked if a Syria ceasefire is a rope-a-dope deal with Russia. In other words, asked if the Syria ceasefire deal is not really that trustworthy. Kerry says it may be so. And also the Arabic TV network Al Arabiya tweeted this, breaking news, John Kerry says that there are several options being considered if a Syria cessation of hostilities does not take hold. So you can see there that the U.S. side is being cautious and trying to get together a backup plan in case this agreement doesn't pan out. Susan?
Okay, well, thank you very much, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
UK researchers looked to the bat for inspiration in developing wings that could be used in constructing a new generation of insect or bird-sized aircraft called micro-air vehicles. They say their new innovation will allow the tiny aircraft to eventually travel much longer distances than currently possible and make them more inexpensive to run. Scientists at the UK's University of Southampton say that their new wings, which they liken to artificial muscles, have improved aerodynamic properties and can quickly respond to various flying conditions by simply changing their shape. While this new technology uses no mechanical parts, it does incorporate electroactive polymers that use electrical current to modify the aerodynamic characteristics of the wing structure. Micro-air vehicles, which can be as small as 15 centimeters, can be used in various commercial and military applications. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The International Coalition is continuing its military campaign against the Islamic State group in Syria and Iraq, but according to retired Lieutenant General Michael Barbero, there is a lot to be done to defeat ISIS and preserve the unity of Iraq. He spoke with International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawi.
The International Coalition has been conducting airstrikes against ISIS for more than a year, and it is still controlling large swaths of land in both Syria and Iraq. What's needed to really defeat ISIS?
Well, I think we need a couple of things. First, we need to understand that ISIS is a network, and you can't just defeat it through airstrikes alone. And to make the airstrikes more effective, we need to have a greater intelligence presence on the ground and a greater effort to identify targets. The second thing, and the only thing that will really defeat ISIS, is a viable ground force. It's got to be an Iraqi security forces. And we're not going to put large numbers of troops on the ground, nor should we. So it has to be a trained and quality Iraqi security force, and in order to get that, we need to improve and increase the level of training and the number of trainers that we have on the ground, because it's just too slow. It's been 18 months since ISIS occupied large parts of Iraq, and they still control 60% of the area they once occupied, to include Mosul. So we need to make a greater investment in intelligence, trainers, and other enablers for Iraqi security forces to be able to clear this ground and to defeat ISIS.
Saudi Arabia offered to send ground troops to Syria if the coalition decided to go that route. but Russia warned against any introduction of ground troops. What's the way out?
Well, the way out, I don't see the other Gulf states contributing ground troops in sufficient numbers or sufficient quality to make a difference. It'll just make it more muddled and more confused and more complex of a challenge. The only way out is through a trained Iraqi security forces and a Sunni population in Iraq, and to become part of this greater Iraq and trust this government in Baghdad. So it must be by building Iraqi capabilities and enabling them with airstrikes and intelligence to be able to clear this ground and retake it from ISIS.
In Iraq, ISIS fighters are well mixed with local citizens, especially in Mosul. How could Mosul be liberated without massive loss of innocent lives?
So the first order is to convince the Sunni population in Mosul that if they reject ISIS, that this government in Baghdad will serve their interests and they can be part of this Iraq that will take care of Sunnis. And you don't do that by sending in Shia militias. So I think it's got to be a Sunni force, Iraqi security forces and Sunni forces that take on the brunt of the fighting against ISIS.
Final question. What would you recommend for the next American president to preserve Iraq's unity and secure a stable Iraq with less Iranian and Russian influences?
It's going to take greater American involvement and investment in Iraq. So I think increased military support, not, you know, tens of thousands of troops on the ground to help accelerate the development of the Iraqi security forces and the defeat of ISIS, plus leading the economic investment to rebuild Anbar, Mosul, and Nineveh province, these key areas that need Saladin province, these Sunni areas that need investment to rebuild after ISIS has been defeated. Defeating ISIS on the ground is just the first step. The second step is rebuilding and incentivizing the Sunni population to pitch in and buy into this Iraqi enterprise. So American leadership can make a difference, and those are the areas where I'd see us taking the lead.
General Michael Barbero, thank you very much for being on the Voice of America.
Thank you, Mohammed. It's always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, a move to close the Guantanamo detention facility and Grammy no-shows.
With this plan, we have the opportunity finally to eliminate a terrorist propaganda tool, strengthen relationships with allies and partners, enhance our national security, and most importantly, uphold the values that bind us as Americans. I'm absolutely committed to closing the detention facility at Guantanamo. I'm going to continue to make the case for doing so as long as I hold this office. But this is a good moment for everybody to step back, take a look at the facts, take a look at the views of those who have been most committed to fighting terrorism and understand this stuff. Our operatives, our intelligence officials, our military. Let's go ahead and get this thing done.
President Obama pledged to close the Guantanamo facility shortly after assuming office in 2009, and he addressed the issue again today. The U.S. Defense Department is submitting a plan to close the controversial base in Cuba, which has housed hundreds of militant fighters captured in the wake of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. Terrorism expert Greg Barton, a professor at Australia's Deakin University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the key to closing Guantanamo is what to do with those detainees remaining.
Roughly a third of them are judged sufficiently low risk to be prospects for being relocated to other countries. That's, of course, taken a very long time, and it should have happened by now. But at least two-thirds, around 60-odd of the I think 96 remaining, will have to be kept in very high-security prisons. Now, the legal rub is that under American law, they can't be brought onto the American mainland and put in the American prison system. Basically, the president has to override that and say, well, we've kept them in a de facto American prison in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. It's kind of a legal fiction to say that's not an American prison. We should do the right thing and bring them back into the formal American prison system. So that's the challenge he's facing. It's not an easy legal challenge. He has the power. It's judged under executive authority. He had hoped the administration would find another way out. They haven't. So this is his last opportunity.
the White House has called Guantanamo Bay a recruitment tool for terrorist groups around the world.
That's right. It's a pamphlet for Al-Qaeda and now for ISIS. There's a lot of substance in that claim. If you want to evoke the ideas of hypocrisy and of miscarriage of justice and of torture, all you have to do is say the word Guantanamo. And of course, until that is dealt with, until Guantanamo is closed, I think that literally is the case. It remains a kind of a pamphlet, a kind of recruiting tool for extremists. And that's a mistake we've made ourselves, and it's a mistake we've got to fix ourselves.
Obviously, there's going to be the showdown with Congress that's inevitable.
Yes. The president clearly didn't want to go this route. He wanted to find another way out. It seems like he's indicating that in his final year in office, he's going to do this thing that he promised he'd do, and he will invoke presidential executive authority. And it remains to be seen how this goes, but the wisdom is that he does have sufficient power to do that. Of course, it's not something he wanted to do earlier in his presidency, presumably because of the political capital it would cost him and distraction. I guess if there's a benefit in being a lame duck president in the last months of office, you can do these sort of things. But it's unlikely he's going to find any support or sufficient support in Congress. It's going to be something he's going to have to simply push through an executive order.
Greg Barton, a professor at Australia's Deakin University. This is VOA.
This is Green Bee for a healthier planet.
Believe it or not, electric cars are not a new idea. The first Porsche car was powered by a battery more than 100 years ago. Still, electric plug-in car sales are far below those of carbon-fueled vehicles. Ron Coltonbow is president of the Washington chapter of the Electric Auto Association.
People really want a vehicle that they want to be able to just hit the open road and go as far as they want to go when they don't do that very often. The combination of range, price, and charging infrastructure, but all three of those things are improving, you know, year by year.
The biggest electric vehicle improvement, says Coltonbow, will be for range and price.
The next 2 years is going to be a turning point because there are at least three or four vehicles that are going to get in that 200-mile range in that mid-30s price point. So that's going to really open some people's eyes.
Out of the more than 17 million cars sold last year in the United States, less than 3% were electric or hybrids. The average range of an electric car motor is currently about 120 kilometers. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
The Grammy Awards ceremony is, of course, one of the big annual highlights in music. Just as fun as it is to see the stars together at one time is to talk about who did not show up. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald joins International Edition's Jim Stevenson to fill us in on the most notable unseen performers at the Grammys.
We're going to talk about the stars who didn't come out at the 2016 Grammy Awards, Jim. First of all, Drake. His name was promoed during a Grammy ad that aired during the Super Bowl. However, apparently that was news to Drake because he went on Twitter and he wrote, "I'm not performing at the Grammy Awards, but hey, it's the thought that counts." So that was pretty cut and dried. Drake was not going to be at the Grammys, and that was that. Lauryn Hill. Things get a little more interesting here. Now, Lauren, of course, has a fairly extensive Grammy history. She released that fantastic album, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, that won her multiple Grammys in the 90s. Billboard reported that Lauren was to have duetted with The Weeknd. However, she issued a statement saying that the Grammys announcement was premature. She had been doing concerts the previous weekend. Furthermore, no performance was ever confirmed. That's how Lauryn Hill explained her absence. The most interesting of them all is Rihanna, because she was actually there at the venue, the Staples Center, for rehearsals. She had confirmed that she was going to sing her new song, Kiss It Better. She turned up for rehearsals, and then E! News reported that doctors had ordered Rihanna to go on 48-hour vocal rest due to a case of bronchitis. Supposedly, she had been on antibiotics for 3 days, and it still hadn't knocked out the infection. However, 2 days earlier, on February 13th, Rihanna had sung for Lionel Richie at the Music Cares Person of the Year event, and a video exists of her singing Say You, Say Me, and, you know, she sounds pretty good. TMZ quotes unnamed sources as saying Rihanna was screaming and hysterical before she walked out of the rehearsals. Those sources also say Rihanna left with Lauryn Hill, so Lauryn apparently made it out there too, and that Rihanna wasn't happy at all about how the rehearsals went. So we have two obviously conflicting stories here. And then as far as other Grammy no-shows go, I suppose we could mention Kanye West, who tweeted that he was boycotting the Grammys until they gave him the Album of the Year award, which would have been impossible in any event because his new album was not released during the eligibility period. So I think we can say that that was just Kanye blowing smoke because he's been all over Twitter lately.
Well, and then we would have had another Kanye-Taylor Swift incident.
Well, it was interesting to note that when Taylor Swift received Album of the Year, her second Album of the Year for 1989, she had a lot of other people on stage with her, and they were sort of forming a protective perimeter around her. I was live tweeting the Grammys, and I was saying, where is Kanye? Does anybody know where Kanye is? Because, of course, what famously happened back in 2009 at the MTV Awards when Kanye bum-rushed Taylor when she received her award. So there it is, some of the more notable no-shows at the 2016 Grammys.
Ray McDonald, our Top 20 Countdown host, and we thank you so much for joining us, Ray. Be sure to follow Ray on Twitter, by the way. What is that stream, Ray?
Ray on the Hits.
Follow him. Thanks so much for joining.
You got it, Jim. Thanks.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. And if you go to VOA Asia, you might be able to catch our live stream of today's show. They were in here for about 10 minutes today, and you can see what we all look like. Anyway, thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Department of Energy Assistant Secretary for International Affairs Jonathan Elkind recently joined Pakistan's Ministry of Planning, Ministry of Water and Power, and Ministry of Petroleum and Natural Resources to announce the launch of a multi-agency technical assistance program designed to support Pakistan's energy development efforts. The three-year effort, conducted in partnership with the U.S. Agency for International Development, will bring experts from the U.S. Department of Energy National Laboratories together with Pakistani energy experts to develop strategies and resources for integrated energy system planning, energy efficiency, and promoting private investment in renewable energy. The program is a component of the U.S.-Pakistan Clean Energy Partnership, announced by President Barack Obama and Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif in October 2015. The partnership aims to develop 3,000 megawatts of new private sector clean power projects in Pakistan, which would directly benefit more than 30 million Pakistanis. The new partnership continues joint efforts by the United States and Pakistan to address Pakistan's energy needs and includes support from several U.S. government agencies. The United States and Pakistan have cooperated on energy issues since 2009 under the Energy Working Group, established through the U.S.-Pakistan Strategic Dialogue, recognizing the critical importance of increasing energy security and access in a clean, sustainable manner. The United States has committed more than $1 billion to date to support energy sector investments and reforms in cooperation with the government of Pakistan. Our cooperative efforts have made over 1,750 additional megawatts available to the national grid, powering the homes and businesses of 19.4 million Pakistanis and increasing the annual revenue of Pakistani distribution companies by over $418 million. The United States is committed to our partnership with Pakistan. We are addressing energy challenges and working together on our shared global energy priorities, including the opportunities presented by a growing renewable energy market, said Assistant Secretary Elkind. We look forward to having American and Pakistani experts collaborate in this critical arena.
That was an editor.